Welcome to Family Matters, the Adoption UK podcast, which is all about sharing stories, conversations and information, and also coming up with great ideas. So my name's Alison Woodhead and I'm your host for today. And in this episode, I'm joined by an adoptee, adopter and social work professional who set up a campaigning group with the wonderfully ambitious goal of reforming adoption support. We're going to be discussing some very difficult issues today, and I wanted to warn people about that. Also, we'll be talking about children with complex needs and sometimes extremely challenging behaviour. So it goes without saying, but I want to say it anyway, that none of this is the children's fault. Adoptive families are in crisis of parenting children who are living with significant trauma, and the fault lies with the trauma, not the child. And today's guest believes the fault lies with the social services system that does not recognise their trauma. So Fiona, please can I ask you to introduce yourself and your campaigning group?
Hi, so I'm Fiona Wells. I am a adoptee, social worker and campaigner, founder of Patch. And the campaign is all about looking a little bit deeper at what's happening in family life and making sure that we are checking in with our psychological perspective on that and where the issues really originate from and how to put a lot more humanity back into our practice to really support families rather than being punitive.
Wonderful, thank you. So the reason we were keen to talk to you on the podcast is that our own research shows that the number of adoptive families in crisis is rising. So as you know, we publish an annual report, piece of research called the Adoption Barometer, and we're in the seventh year of that. And so we've got a bit of history behind it. We're able to track some patterns. And what we can see is that the number of families reporting that they're facing significant challenges or in crisis is rising. So last year, 38% of adoptive families responding to the barometer described themselves as facing severe challenges or reaching crisis point, and that compared to 30% the year before. So quite a big jump just in one year. Adoptive families also less likely to feel optimistic about their family's future than in any previous adoption barometer, and three quarters agreed that it felt like a continual battle to get the support their child needs. 60% of respondents had experienced violent or aggressive behaviour directed towards them from their child, and 23% of children were suspected to have harmed themselves or attempted to do so, although I think that's a surprisingly low figure, and I think it's probably tip of the iceberg. And then sort of at the, I suppose, at the worst end of the spectrum, around 7% of families, and that's a consistent figure from this year's research and last year's, every year are having a child leaving the home prematurely. So whether that's to go back into foster care, secure children's home, whether it's sofa surfing, whether it's going back to birth family, it could be a range of destinations. But that figure has more than doubled since 2021, according to the Adoption Barometer. So this is obviously a difficult but very important conversation. And I wanted to ask you if you could talk a bit about the personal and professional journey that led you to set up Patch.
Yeah, of course. And absolutely big believer in the barometer. It's a great source of information. And I think of hope for a lot of us being able to see what we're living and experiencing on paper, you know, in a data produced way. And it's a, in a way, a beacon of hope for us that actually we're being heard and listened to.
That's a very interesting phrase, because you do use the word hope, and
massively.
Actually, the barometer is a pretty gloomy read. So tell me why you say it gives you hope.
Because actually the complexities of what families are struggling with is being recognised, and we can't change things unless there's recognition. And that's where the hope comes in. If we are seeing it and we are talking about it and we are recognizing it, then the hope of something happening is the after effect. And that's why the barometer is so important for me. And I will always champion people to complete it, to engage in it, to read it, to see it, to to push for it to be even more, you know, widely spread. It is our way of being recognised as people who are struggling, because those numbers, those figures, that increase from 30 to 38% is a massive piece of evidence to say something needs to change. So that's why the barometer is really important to me and to Patch. So back to your question. When I was a social worker, I became aware of some of the language within social work teams where families in adoption were in crisis. So certain elements, and as an adopter, you and a social worker, it's quite hard to say that you're facing challenges because of the lens that's used. But it was comments such as like, well, they knew what they were signing up for. And what did they think it was going to be fun? You know, and it's kind of like, really, that's not appropriate. And then I became involved in Facebook community groups, and I was watching things on the internet and talking to people. And I became really aware of how many families were not just being failed, but being blamed for not managing adoption crisis. And it scared me professionally, emotionally, personally, whichever way you want to put it. And I remember at the time it hit me most was when I was starting to face our crisis had hit quite young with our children, and I was starting to get to a point where I couldn't manage, and I became more invested in listening to people and hearing what people had to say, and more horrified about the stories. And I hadn't experienced what these other families had experienced. And I felt fortunate, I suppose, in a way, because I had the language to navigate with professionals. I had the language to protect myself. So I created a document called The Jarring Reality of Adoption Crisis, which was 33 different stories, lived experience stories of people's, you know, the crisis that hit and how they were failed and blamed and how their lives just got torn up by something that was supposed to be supportive and actually wasn't. So that was the first starting block, but it hadn't become Patch at that point. It was a little while later that I actually faced blame as a social worker and as an adopter of three children. I was in crisis, and for one reason or another, and obviously I'm not going to share their story or other stories.
Sure.
But,
yeah.
My husband at the time wasn't in a very good place, and I was left with three children, and we'd had 9, I think, social care assessments, psych assessments, ed psych assessments, clinical psychological assessments. I mean, we'd had them all, which cost a lot of money.
Yeah.
And they all recognised there was issues, that there was complex behaviours stemming from early life trauma. And then when I hit the crisis button, I got blamed. Well, you know, you're not coping, and therefore you're becoming a risk. Okay. So they
and did they use that word? Risk,
risk, emotional harm, which was horrific, because I had to step back from my social work role, and I felt eyes on and I felt judged, but I was in crisis. There was lots of volatile, challenging, violent behavior in the house, and when I asked for help, I didn't get it. I got judged, I got blamed. The punitive actions were horrific, but it came to a head as they decided to pull a child protection conference on me. And I sat there for 3.5 hours and said, where's your evidence? Where is the evidence? Have you read the 9 other assessments on my children that say that their early life trauma causes complex behaviour, and that actually mum is doing her very best, and that mum is managing and navigating very, very complex situations, and all these wonderful things it said about me and my children, because they are bloody wonderful. Not once did any of those 9 assessments say that mum could do better, or mum wasn't doing well enough, or mum, you know, nothing. There was nothing in there. I was really lucky. I had 5 professionals sat around the table who said, you've let mum down. As a local authority, you've let mum down. Mum asked you for help in crisis, and she has gone above and beyond, and she's done everything. She's been transparent, she's been honest, she's been open, she's always put the children's needs first, she's always asked for help, she's always maintained that actually, even if the children are the very, very, very most volatile behavior, we need to check in with them to see how they are after they've done something, you know. And I was able to navigate that because I'm a social worker and I knew the language and I knew how to navigate it. And then my fuel in my tank for Patch, just the volume just went. I was fired up. I was angry. And I don't like being angry. Angry is not something I like. I'm quite a feisty person generally, but I don't like being angry. So what I decided was that I had to put it somewhere. And so what went from the jarring reality of adoption crisis came Patch. But I'm very fearful of being somebody who comes across as an angry, hard done to person. What I wanted it to be was I wanted my passion to show. I wanted the change is the outcome we need, not let's go over all of the negativity over and over and over again and talk about things in circles, that we were doing with hope. So that's where Patch came in. But I also had a patchwork quilt as a kid that my mum never finished.
Ah.
And it always stayed with me. And she still hasn't finished it. And I'll tell her that later. But I also had a cabbage patch doll as well. And then being adopted, it's like we're stitched together. And sometimes we could be frayed a little bit because of everything's going on, and we might need mending, and it just resonated with me. So we became Patch, which is Passionate Adopters Targeting Change with Hope, and I bloody love the word now, the name, and I'm sticking with it. And since then I've built a community. I say community, we've got a Facebook group that's got nearly 1500 members. I have a committee group called the Steering Group. There's 22 of us. I've had meetings with over 73 professionals or organisations within the last 2 years. But then I've also done things like attend the Barometer launch, which I love. And I'm attending Family Right Group Parent Panel and the Doctor Reference Group Panel. And I'm trying to speak to as many local authorities and RAAs to share the views of Patch. And what we did this year was we created two documents. One is that we know you're professionals, you've not got much time, here's the short summary.
Yep.
And then the other one is that you can pop in and out of chapters and see what you like. And it's been really successful. I'm doing some training for some social workers in different local authorities. I'm having more conversation with heads of services. I've met with a charity today and I've met with a local authority today. And there's a lot going on, but I also still work as a social worker.
Okay. So, and the document that you're just describing is called the Patch Pathway, and people can find that on the Patch website. So if you just Google Patch Fiona Wells, it'll come up with the website, and then you can find it. So I just want to take a step back before we take a step forward. So I haven't ever been involved in safeguarding proceedings, and I know a lot of people listening to this podcast won't have been either. So can you just tell us a little bit about actually what happened? So as you say, you hit the crisis button, and what happens? So what do you mean by that, and what happened as a result?
So I wasn't managing. I had three children, and again, I just reiterate, this isn't their fault. It absolutely is not their fault, who had really tricky behaviours that bubbled and bubbled and bubbled and became hard to manage. So by that, what I mean by that is child to parent violence.
Yeah.
And I was the only one who got it, as in the only adult. My daughter got it as well. And it was really hard to manage their complex needs as a single parent, which I didn't start off as, with three of them who needed one of me each. Because of their attachment needs, because of their trauma responses, because of their insecurities in navigating the world, they needed a parent each. And I couldn't provide that, let alone even close, because I was one person. I was still having to work, earn a living, you know. When I asked for help, I wanted respite, not permanently, not long term. I wanted some short times. At the point, I was having to ring my elderly parents to get them to come down and let me have a shower. Because I couldn't leave the children on their own. Or I was having to get a babysitter, and the only one I could get was an 18-year-old who I didn't leave her on her own with them, but because it was more complex than... My children are absolutely beautiful, intelligent, very pleasing to the eye, should we say. So... also quite sneaky and manipulative at times, cheeky, I think you could call them. So, right. So having a babysitter around was a way of me being able to turn my back for a few minutes. It wasn't really rest. I also wanted therapeutic interventions that fitted the family, and they suggested parenting courses. Well, I'd been on 9. I'd even been on residential conferences about therapeutic parenting a few years before. There was nothing I didn't know. And actually, in crisis, you can't learn anything new.
No.
I was exhausted. I was tired. I was developing PTSD. I was getting hit every day.
So you rang your... You rang your adoption support team, is that what happened? And said,
well,
they
already knew us because they'd done a psych assessment on the children, they'd done post adoption assessments. We were starting to get some clinical psychological EDMR for me, and then crisis was just too much. So when I asked for help, they said, oh, we're gonna have to, because of some of the risks that weren't to do with me. It came into children's social care, you know, teenagers running away, things like that.
Right.
And then the social worker decided that they'd call a meeting, a strategy discussion, which is what is the beginning of a social work inquiry.
Right.
Except none of the professionals in the room knew me, and none of them knew the children. And I got told by the head teacher of my children's primary school that she didn't agree and she wasn't consulted. Well, all three of my children went to two schools, and neither of the professionals agreed with this. So it was people reading information off a computer. It happened really, really fast. I didn't have a lot of time to sit down with these professionals. Nobody came to walk with me and talk with me or really consider what was going on. Nobody wanted to hear. It turned out the social worker hadn't read anything on the system about the children, about their needs, about the fact that there were behaviours in school that weren't like what I was talking about, but they were behaviours that indicated there was a bigger picture. And so having a safeguarding referral, and somebody contacted me the other day and she said, I think you should talk to families about how to navigate safeguarding referrals, because I've had 14. She said,
wow.
She said, I've had 14. Not one of them went anywhere, but I've had 14. And I was like, why are we being so punitive to put in safe? And actually what it amounts to is that people are making judgments and decisions based on what they can see at the top of the shallows, at the top of the surface. They're not looking any deeper. They're not looking any further.
And these are professionals. So, as you say, they weren't known to the family. They didn't know the children. And so that, as far as I understand it, it tends to be what happens. So when safeguarding concerns arise, it's a totally different team of social workers who are kind of flown into the situation. And they're new to that situation. They're not even necessarily adoption informed.
No, not at all. So we'd had two frontline social workers prior to that who said, mum's amazing, mum's great, amazing that she's navigating this. However, she's got post-adoption support. Unfortunately, and I don't know the professional terminology here, local authority social workers take precedence over RAA social workers. It's a common factor, and it's child protection trumps trauma. I don't get it. I don't believe in it. And I don't agree with it. I think we need to be rather more considered in our psychological lenses than we are about being punitive. In fact, I spoke to a children's services lead today who said we shouldn't be looking under a child protection lens with a family in adoption crisis. And that is exactly right. It does not mean to say that doctors don't do things wrong. It does not mean that there are not safeguarding risks with families where the carer, adopter, kinship carer, foster carer has not
harmed the child. Made mistakes or, yeah, exactly.
But we have to be really clear. The evidence has to be absolutely on point. We cannot go along, make a decision and not back it with evidence. And unfortunately, that was what happened with me. It was judgment. It was bias. It was oppressive. Right. And I even got laughed at in the corridor because I was a social worker coming out to find there was a child protection conference going to be held. I was laughed at. I heard them talking about me. She's in the waiting room. Go and see what she looks like. I was the only one in the waiting room. And obviously, I used to work for this local authority. So obviously, I was a bit of a spectacle in that point of view. So it wasn't fair. It wasn't just. The evidence wasn't there. The other professionals in the room sided with me and not with the local authority. And I'm not going to go into the rest of my family story because it's not for me to tell that. But let's just say the fundamental, the crisis was one thing. What happened afterwards broke us apart.
Yeah.
And I don't live with all my children now. Mm. Through my choice, in a way, because I couldn't carry on living in crisis.
Yeah.
And that has broken me. I'm still mum. I still see them. I'm still very much their mum.
Yeah.
Every day, in and out. But what could have happened was they could have supported me and I could have carried on. And I am the most important person in my children's lives. And they should be able to live with me every day.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing all of that. And I should say that, you know, I've heard many similar stories and obviously so have you, and that's the reason that you've set up Patch, because you're one person amongst many who've had similar experiences. I also just wanted to say that there'll be people listening to this who don't live in England, and so I'm sorry for terminology that we use that doesn't make sense to you, but so for example RAA is a regional adoption agency and not all nations have those, so apologies for that. I wanted to pick up something that I thought was quite interesting from the Patch document, which is about the way that social workers mirror the trauma that they find that they're finding in families. So the sort of threat or the threat response.
Oh, threat response. Yeah. So I'm really passionate about building change, but I wanted to make sure that I had educated myself enough. So I booked onto a trauma course with Betsy Deterian. And through that, I've learnt loads, and it's quite a hefty course, and it's been amazing. And while I was on it, I was thinking, okay, so this is an unknown fact, really, but social workers would resonate with this. When you're working with families and you work with a family who are quite intelligent and intellectual and know stuff, like it's quite daunting and scary. Like, I've had families who are solicitors before, and I've been like, oh no, you know, I'm so not going to compete with that sort of level of intellect. It can be quite daunting, but it's also working with somebody who's in a heightened level of stress, because it's daunting as well. I can't tell you how many times I've been verbally assaulted as a social worker. It can be, and you're dealing with families in crisis, so you think about all that together collectively, and not all social workers come out who are absolutely confident and, you know, full of like their learning and experience. They're on a journey too, but when we're in crisis as people, we can't learn, we don't listen that well. What we hear is empathy or compassion or somebody walking with us. What we don't hear is criticism. That is just a further threat. That is, we are going to feel physically unwell. We are going to react. I liken it to this story. And obviously, I'm not giving any details, but I was working with a woman whose partner had assaulted her and her children. And this is many years ago. And she had her own cleaning company. And she wouldn't leave her house after it had been smashed to smithereens. But she made sure her children were safe. But I needed her to go to the hospital and have a checkup, because she'd been assaulted. But she wouldn't leave the house. And I kind of was like, my instinct was like, we need to get her to the hospital. She could have like a brain injury. I had to ring some of her family members with her consent and say, you know, I think need to intervene here. She needs to go to a hospital. And I kind of done some training about threat responses. And I just thought, just a minute, what is stopping her? What is it that's stopping her think about her own needs? And I thought, right, she's in a threat response. She's fighting for something, but I couldn't quite work out what it was. It wasn't me, because we were fine. We got on really well. I hadn't known her very long. And I worked out that because her house was a mess and she was a cleaner, That was right. a massive problem for her. So sometimes it's just trying to triangulate what's going on for somebody, work out where they're at, make sense of it and help them through it without a judgment. So what, and also the other element was she couldn't find her phone and she couldn't ring her clients to say she wasn't going to come and clean her house, and she's self-employed. So nobody else was going to pick up the phone and say something had happened. So we cleaned the house together and we found the phone and we got her to the hospital and we got checked out. Now, how simple is that? It's really simple. So it's about that whole human, that value. I value what you're feeling right now and I want to help you through it. Not the, right, how can we make you a better parent?
Yeah.
And there's the difference. If you come out in a threat response that is saying, I'm coming here to make this crisis go away because you need to be a better parent or you need to do things differently, and you're already in crisis, we've basically got threat response versus threat response versus threat response, which is only ever going to lead to poor outcomes. And then the other element is that a lot, some social work practice is very child protection orientated, which means it's punitive and there's a lot of bias and blame and oppressive practice within that. And that, again, is something we need an evolution on. We need to change that. We need to change the narrative. We need to change the scope. And we need to understand parents a lot more. Birth parents, adopters, foster carers, kinship care. It doesn't matter who you are. We need to have more empathy regardless of the situation somebody's in.
And, of course, we also need brave social work bosses who are training and equipping their teams to do the kind of job that you just described with the woman who owned a cleaning company.
Absolutely. And I think that's, you know, it's about having conversations and about building conversations. So, for instance, if you have learning circles or peer group sessions within a local authority, or you have people with lived experience coming to talk to you, you are going to learn so much more than you are sitting in a room watching a PowerPoint presentation about we need empathy in our practice. Actually, what you need to understand is how to be curious, how to wonder out loud, how to connect the dots, how to question things. And that has to be a top-down approach. Leaders need to teach social workers to be more curious what that means in practice, to show them what that means in practice. But I think it's about joining the dots together again, and there's so much of this is just about humanity and joining up our dots in our work and our practice, and always being curious about what do you not know.
Yeah, what's really going on here.
Absolutely.
So there's another thing that I wanted to ask you about within the patch pathway, which is around this thing of not seeing the trauma in our children and planning for their recovery. So you say, you know, sort of at the heart of this is just that we don't see the children's trauma and we don't see the impact of that.
Yeah.
Well, we see the impact. We don't really see the trauma and understand the trauma. But I guess a lot of social workers would say, you know, that's what multidisciplinary assessments are for. And now we've got a new adoption support plan. So for families in England, they're now getting a standalone adoption support plan, which is written on the back of a multidisciplinary assessment and is intended to be a sort of foundational document which not only sees the child's trauma but then says, okay, so what do we need to do to support that individual child theoretically in the long term, not just upon placement, although there's still some work to do on that last bit. But nonetheless, you know, they would say that's what the ASGSF is for, that's what, you know, that's what our core support offer is for. So what do you mean when you say we're not seeing the trauma in our children?
So, and I think this is where it's not about adoption. It's not about fostering. It's not. It's about every child. Every child where a local authority is about to pick up a phone or do a referral to a solicitor to say, we need legal advice. We need legal advice because we think the harm and the trauma that this child's experiencing is too much and we may have to remove. At that point, what's being missed is we are not making sense of what And obviously safeguarding and risk has to be the priority. So if a child's in danger, we always have to put that first. But what we're not doing is we're not making sense of what their experiences mean to their life. So we're not respecting their journey. We're not valuing their journey. We're not letting it implement. We're not letting it tell us how to make sure that we get the best out of their world. And this isn't to say that we need to plan and go, oh, well, OK, they've been through so much, we'll just write them off. This is about making sure that we can really plot and plan their recovery and their repair from trauma. We can be trauma responsive to ensure that they get everything they need out of life. But let's go back to the very beginning. Little Kenny, and I always use the word Kenny, the name Kenny, Kenny or Jimmy for some reason. Little Kenny has been found wandering the streets at 3 years old on his own at night. Okay. So Kenny is removed by the police and Kenny is put into an emergency foster placement. We find out who Kenny is and we begin inquiries, etc. What we're not doing there and then is opening a document that's called, I don't know, for instance, I'll name it after what I call it, impact pathway.
Yeah.
Okay. So in this impact pathway, we have information about what we know. We know that generally children walking the streets at night are neglected. There can be one-off incidents, obviously. I'm sure lots of parents can say that, you know, that there can be one-off incidents, but generally a child 3 year old walking the street is a big indicator of neglect. Okay. Mm. But what does that word mean? What does that neglect look like? Not what it means in a hypothesis or a, you know, an analysis in a social works assessment, but what is it? So does that mean he knew when he was getting fed? Does that mean his nappies were always left on?
Mm.
Does that mean he, you know, he didn't know when somebody was going to come and soothe him?
Mm.
So it's about taking that very, very basic information and making sense of it. But it's also about considering what you don't know.
Right.
So we don't know from our story about Kenny is who did Kenny actually get soothed from? Mm. Who came and soothed him when he was upset?
Yeah.
You know, which person in his life gave him porridge in the morning or his Weetabix? You know, it's about painting a whole picture about every element of their child's world and making sense of it so that we can then determine what we need to do and put in place.
And you don't think that's happening at the moment? Obviously
no.
Not.
No.
So at the point at which a child is coming into care and then when they're being placed for adoption, isn't that supposed to happen exactly what you're describing?
No. So what, from my point of view and what I've done in the past as a worker, is we make sense of what we need the courts to see. We need to make sense of what we want the parents to know, that why are we worried? Why are we worried? We're worried because little Kenny was walking the streets at 3 o'clock and you didn't know where, you as mum didn't know where your child was. And we're really worried that this could happen again. So we're looking at it from an adult focused safeguarding lens.
Right, right.
Where we're examining the situation.
Yeah. Rather than from Kenny's perspective. It's not about what Kenny has experienced.
Yeah, it's not about where's the risk, where's the harm, what has happened, as in what are we worried about happening again. It's more intricate than that. You know, a lot of children, they come through the care proceedings and there's a lot, and this is not for me saying that social work is done badly all of the time across all the board. What I'm saying is we just need to add a few more elements to it. There is some very bad social work practice, sure. Don't get me wrong, but I don't blame social workers either. This is about what's changing practice. This piece of work isn't about the court, it isn't about parents, it isn't about giving to a GP for the adoption medical. This is about Kenny. This is about what is good that's happened, what is bad that's happened, what could have been really remarkable for him, what has imprinted on him, what part of his journey is going to bubble when he gets older. So for instance, a child who's been through emotional neglect is likely to have a tendency towards violence because research tells us.
Right.
You know, a child who doesn't know when their next meal's coming is likely to have issues with food throughout their life, as well as, you know, their sort of sense of self when it comes to healthy eating, etc. You know, so it's not about us making assumptions. It's not about us making judgments. It's about painting a picture of that child's world, making sense of it, and knowing how to help him get the most out of his life. But there's also a second part. The second part is having that impact pathway that can be transported through that child's life, done protectively regardless of, you know, adoption and fostering and all the rest of it. It also means that carers, parents, whatever, do not have to repeat themselves over and over and over again, saying, this is what happened to Kenny, this is why we think he's got bubbly behaviours and complex needs, and this is why we're struggling. Instead, a professional who, you know, has rights to read it, because not everybody, can see, actually, this happened to Kenny, and actually was predicted that at some point these trauma symptoms, not, you know, they're complex needs, but their trauma symptoms have bubbled and become an issue. And actually, these were the recommendations back then, and we need to give that some thought. But actually, we now understand what mum and dad are saying, or dad and mum, or dad and dad, or whatever. We understand what they're saying, and we're actually going to take note of it. Because how many of us adopters have not been believed when we've said? You know, even on the last report that was written, they couldn't get it right what local authority my children originally came from. They didn't look to see what I was saying about their history. It was just, we don't see what mum's saying. We don't acknowledge what mum's saying. They said that in the report. So it's about making this journey, regardless of the child's going back to mum and dad or going into foster care. We need to do an impact map that makes more sense from Kenny's point of view.
Okay, so now we're talking about solutions. So you, as you say, you've created this thing, or you've set out what you're calling an impact pathway. So what is that, and how would it work? Because I think, you know, we can all agree about the principles that you're describing. So greater humanity in the safeguarding system, a better understanding of trauma, a child-centered approach, all of those good things. But what is it that you think is going to make a difference? So what is this impact pathway? Talk to us about that.
So the impact pathway isn't a finished item. It's my view, a grassroots view, collectively with views from the community, Patch community. And it does need some fine tuning. It's not the finished article. It needs fine tuning from somebody who's psychologically trained, neuroscience, whatever, because I'm not that. And I can't.
Right.
I can't prescribe a therapy or a treatment or a, you know, and I'm not saying that this should, but it definitely needs fine tuning by somebody with the right expertise, which is another one of my bugbears. We have to have the right expertise to make the right decisions, not social workers on trauma. So, but there needs to be a stage back. When a child is adopted or put into foster care, having a clean pillowcase and a care plan that says they're going to this school, or they've got this GP, or they're going to have yearly contact with A, B, and C isn't enough. That is basically saying us adults have decided this is what's happening to you, and that you're going to be all right now. But that child doesn't always know. Their core processing doesn't always know that they're safe, because triggers happen constantly in a child's life. So whilst, you know, little Kenny is in the care of, I don't know, Sarah, the foster carer, it doesn't mean that he doesn't know he's staying there forever. So we need to just try and bed that child into whatever setting a little bit more. And that's around that safety is not the same as recovery.
Yeah.
And we need to see that, and we need to think about it. We need to triangulate it, and we need to make sure that our approach isn't going, oh, well, love's enough. You're safe. We've decided you're safe, so there you say, therefore you're safe. A child's core processing doesn't know they're safe. You know, I can remember the times where I've worked with kids where their anxiety goes through the roof because it's becoming tea time.
Yeah.
Or a child who's not been fed in a regular routine manner doesn't get hungry at tea time, so doesn't understand why we're having a meal. You know, not my kids, but when I've worked in residentials. You know, so it's about it's about more than just deciding because there's a care plan or there's a permanent stamp that they're safe and they feel loved. Love is not enough. It never will be enough. And it's really sad and tragic, but it's the fact. So the impact pathway needs work, as it needs polishing. But what it is it's something that it's a tool that maps lived experience and it identifies recovery needs. Now, this isn't prescriptive in to say, well, you know, little Kenny needs 12 weeks of, you know, cognitive behavior therapy. Yeah. It's not like that. It's about what does he need from carers? You know, what is he likely to want from a school? What, you know, how many children need a safe space in school to go and deregulate? You know, to go and say, I've got, there's too much. You know, we're very quick to diagnose with autism and ADHD, but actually some of the stuff we're dealing with is trauma. So if we can develop plans that look more about how to manage a child's trauma symptoms rather than seeing them as behaviours, then we're more likely to get a better outcome. Mm. So it also highlights the challenges that parents and carers may face. Again, we're not writing any child off. We're being honest. Mm. We're being open. We're being transparent. Little Kenny was emotionally neglected. Therefore, there is a likelihood that at some point he may become volatile or aggressive, or he may struggle to manage his trauma symptoms to a point that he poses a risk to another child, something like that. But it talks about how, you know, how, what this means to a parent, what this means to Kenny, what does this mean for professionals working with Kenny's family? You know, it looks at the visible and hidden factors impacting on a child's well-being. So your hidden factors is he didn't know when he was getting his next meal when he was at home with mum. But also, you know, he's got a really good appetite. Oh, that's great. Yeah, he's got a really good, oh, he could eat so much. Okay, actually, that's a trauma response. Right. You know, so it's about looking at closer. And again, this has to be done with the right people and by the right professionals with the right lens. It identifies gaps, patterns, missing information, and looks at targeted interventions. But again, not as prescriptive, but as ideas.
Yeah, okay.
You know, and it could even be, if you think about it, you know, if you've got a matching panel between a child and an adopter, it could be that there's a bigger conversation. Okay, this is Kenny. Kenny's coming to live with Sarah and John. And actually, we need to have a meeting with their support network because actually Kenny's going to have these needs and we need the support network to know. Mm. You know, that is rearing a village around this child to say, actually, we need to know how to help Sarah and John. Care for Kenny. And actually, we need to tool up the support network to manage this.
Well, that's a whole other conversation, isn't it? And wouldn't that be wonderful? Yeah.
That would be really wonderful because I can't tell you, I've been a mum for 13 years and I still struggle to get my parents to understand what I'm saying when it comes to trauma symptoms.
I think it's very difficult. I think all of us, yeah, however wonderful and supportive our families and friends are, it's very difficult if you're not in the middle of it. But that doesn't mean to say we shouldn't try and equip people as best we can.
Absolutely. And I think that open, transparent dialogue face to face in a room, your son and his husband are thinking of adopting little Jimmy. Jimmy's going to have this come with him because this is what his life has done. This is his needs. These are his trauma symptoms. You're going to have to support these family members of yours. This is what might happen. We build their knowledge and their resilience that way and their strength as a family not to fall into crisis.
So I'm jumping about a bit, but just on that, of course, one of the risks of talking about crisis and challenging behaviour and being more honest about the things that we're likely to face as adopters risks putting prospective adopters off coming forward. And we know that, so at the moment we're facing a bit of a recruitment crisis in England. We know the Department for Education is very concerned about that. And we are all advocates for adoption where it's the right decision for a particular child. So how do you square that in your mind?
Oh, well, I have a lot to say on this one. If we are recruiting people to adopt and we are failing them, that's a travesty. The system is failing families constantly at the moment. There is people in crisis. I have not met somebody who's survived teenage years as an adoptive parent, I hate that phrase, but as a parent of a child with a trauma history and not needed some support at some point. And if we, and that's not to say I've met everybody, because I haven't, but
sometimes I think you have.
Well, yeah, there's a lot of people in the network, but we need to stop failing children. And this isn't just about children who were adopted. I've worked in foster care as a social worker. We are not taking notice of their trauma, what their journey has done to them. And we are devaluing them by ignoring it. And actually, there's a massive lack of transparency when it comes to matching within adoption, fostering, and all the rest of it. So for me, if recruitment suffers because families are being failed, as tremendously awful as they're being family they're failed, then so be it, because I want there to be a crisis in recruitment, because I would not want any other person going through what I've been through and what other families have been through. And I know that's controversial. And I know it's controversial also that, you know, there's a lot of outcry about the cuts. The cuts matter. It's very
you mean
tragic.
The cuts,
however,
to the adoption and special guardianship support fund, right?
Yeah,
which, by the way, for people not in England, you know, you don't have.
Google it.
And we Google it, but also
Google it.
You know, we were really conscious in England that you don't have any funding at all for this stuff, and so we're speaking from a relative position of privilege, but yeah, sorry Fiona to interrupt you.
That's fine. Sorry about that. The cuts are awful. I agree that, you know, that there's a big campaign to march, and, you know, people want to be heard about that. For me, that's the icing on the cake of failings. Mm. The failings are substantial. We are getting, there's so many adopters now who aren't getting to the adoption order. They are disrupting before the adoption order because they have ended up in a situation with a child that they thought they knew about who's not anything like this, they were said. And that's not me saying we need rosy children for rosy endings, but we do need honesty and transparency. And the matching that's going on within adoptions and fostering is quite poor. You know, we've got families where they've been matched, you know, somebody who's sat there honestly and openly and shared their history of, I've been through this, therefore it may be wise to avoid a child who's extremely volatile. And then they're placed with a really extremely volatile child. You know, that's going to fall apart regardless of who you are. And, you know, if you've got that history, it's going to fall apart. We need to make better decisions. We need to stop failing people. We need to be recovery focused. We need to be trauma responsive. If recruitment suffers, then I'm sorry. I'm glad, because I do not want families going through what I've went through. And I do not want families going through what nearly over 1,500 people on the Facebook group, and obviously not everyone's there because they've been through crisis. But if you are dealt with punitively because you're in crisis, because trauma symptoms within your children ignored, where is the value on that child's life? Never mind the value on the parent's life. What about the value on the child's life?
Yeah.
To this day, the disrespect that my children were shown by attempts to put me as a mum of three children, to put me on a child protection, my children on a child protection plan. The disgust I have is because their journey, their trauma, their bubbles, their wobbles, their things were not seen. And they were devalued, and their journey was disrespected in my mind. We need to do better by children, regardless of where they're going. It doesn't matter whether they're going to kinship care, adoption, you know, whatever.
And of course, the Children's Minister has recently acknowledged in Parliament that adoption support isn't good enough and we need to do better. Unfortunately, that came at the same time as making cuts to the SGSF, so it was a bit ironic. But you know, we have to believe that she believes that. I do believe that she's speaking authentically about that. And but we need to hold our feet to the fire for it. And I think that some of the distress about the adoption and special guardianship support fund changes is the tip of the iceberg, because it's families who have been failed earlier on in their journey who have reached crisis point that are reaching out for help via the ASGSF often. And so it's not just about the fund, the outcry. I think that march on Saturday the 3rd of May is about distress about lack of support more generally.
Yeah.
I think the ASGSF is to some extent symbolic, although, you know, we have been contacted by families who have said our family will break down. This will mean our child will attempt suicide again. This will mean we can no longer cope. So I think it's a real thing as well as being symbolic, probably.
I think it's tragic. The whole situation is tragic, because at the end of the day, it's about money. But actually, if we used a more curious and child-centered model to start with that actually looked at an impact pathway and said, okay, these are the troubles that may come across, we need to make sure that these families are aware of that, they're knowledgeable, they're strengthened, their support network is, we actually would save money. But we're also, there's a waste of money also, because a lot of the interventions aren't based on evidence. So let's send a parent on a parenting course, waste of money. Let's send a parent waste of money when in crisis, I should be really clear.
Let's
do some lower level interventions. What we need to be is really focused on being trauma responsive and how that child is helped to recover and how the parents are strengthened to manage everything. That's not any critical lens for the parent. It's just that absolutely horrendously hard to manage three children in crisis, or one child in crisis, doesn't matter.
I can't imagine what you've been through as a family and many other families are going through. It's important that where people feel they can speak out, that they do. But obviously there are also lots and lots of families who are kind of suffering in silence. And so we're talking on their behalf as well as those of us who are more vocal.
And that's one of Patch things, really, is I want adopters to know, or kinship carers, foster carers, SGO carers, you're not on your own. Patch doesn't offer any support from a peer-to-peer support or anything like that. But what we are is we're a community who get it. We're a community who understand what it's like to live with complex children, even though it's not their fault. You are not to blame as a parent for being in crisis. And that is one of the core factors of why Patch is growing, because people are so grateful to feel that they aren't in this on their own.
Mm. So what, I guess this is a sort of wrap up kind of a question, but what you were saying earlier on about all the different people that you've spoken to, all the different stakeholders, the adoption agencies, the senior social workers, the civil servants in the Department for Education who are responsible for adoption support, etc. What kind of response are you getting to those conversations? What how do they go?
Amazing. I've not had one bad conversation. In fact, they've all inspired me more. You know, somebody sitting across from you saying, God, you're right. Or saying, yeah, there's something we can take from that. Or, do you know what, Fiona? We cannot sit here and tell you you're wrong. Mm. We cannot sit here and tell you things don't need to change. You know, the one comment I get most is, oh, we've heard this before. We've heard these stories. And we do want to make changes. And I know change is hard and I know change costs and it's timely. But actually, some of the stuff in the Patch pathway document is free. It doesn't cost anything for local authorities to utilise lived experience to check on systems and processes. It doesn't cost anything to look into a child's life a little bit more. It doesn't cost anything to remember the journey of a child and why their parents are in crisis. It doesn't cost anything to just reflect and what is really going on for a family. So whilst there's lots of uproar about cuts and all the rest of it, change can be done for free. Mm. And one of the things Patch is offering, although I work full time as well, I will be a sounding board if somebody says, well, what about this? Or we're in this situation for, you know, I'm willing to give my opinion, and it's a grassroots opinion.
Yeah.
I've lived it, I've breathed it as a social worker, as an adopter, and I don't understand, like I wasn't removed. So I don't understand that journey of this situation,
right.
But I understand
right.
what it feels like to be adopted.
Yes.
From a, you know, as a 48-year-old, you know, so there's lots.
Not that you were adopted when you were 48, just to be clear.
No, thank God. but yeah, you know, there's lots of things that can be done to improve people's lives. And when those improvements are made and there's a difference in the way families are treated by social care when in crisis, then I will be all for recruitment being built, because I love adoption and I believe in adoption, but I believe in children more.
All right. Well, that feels like a really good place to finish. So thank you so much, Fiona,
for
giving us your time for the Family Matters podcast, for sharing so much of your personal story. I know there's like the tip of the iceberg, and you've been very careful to protect your family and particularly your kids. But you have shared quite a lot with us, and that's been incredibly valuable. But thanks also for being constructive and, you know, solutions focused, and that's the kind of hope part of your mission, isn't it?
Absolutely.
And that's sometimes difficult to remember to be hopeful in the midst of crisis. But I do feel that perhaps the tide is turning a little bit, that perhaps we're getting to the point where we might be able to make some change happen, and that's exciting and hopeful. So we join you in that spirit. And for those who are listening, do have a look at the Patch website, and there are a couple of webinars on there. There's a bunch of signposting. There's a load of blogs. So have a look at that. And on the Adoption UK website, you'll find information about the support that we provide, including clinical support and peer support. And we also have an information and support line, which you can find the number 4 on the website. This Family Matters podcast is brought to you by Adoption UK, and you can listen to it on all major platforms. And please subscribe to receive the latest episodes and to help us to explore and share many more interesting and important topics. And Fiona, I'm sure we'll have you on again at some point when
Wonderful.
We're a little bit further down the line. All the best, and many thanks to everybody for listening.
Thanks very much.